Hello and welcome to Public Access America. This is Just the Tip.
Hey everybody, welcome to Just the Tip in Public Access America. I am actually recording this ahead of the show, and it made me think Just the Tip would be a good time to check your audio levels is before you actually do everything. So I always take a half hour and I check my computer volumes, I check my Scarlett volumes, and I check my microphone volumes. Those are all volumes as well as the Zoom connection that you should check before you actually go on air. You know, you want to keep your audio consistent. And Jeffrey has a headset that keeps consistent, and now I do too. And so it's really exciting that we can provide you that audio quality. So thank you for being here. Let's get into the show. This is a good one. Jeffrey's an expert on a lot of this stuff.
No. I just haven't had enough coffee to use my brain yet today.
It's time now for something positive.
We might be headed to the promised land.
The promised land, speaking the truth and finding our external liberty once we internally liberate ourselves.
The problem can only be solved when there is a kind of coalition of conscience.
Because that is how it works.
This is the beginning. It is not the finale. And that's why we're here. And that's why we rally.
We've got to be that creative minority.
Find a way to get in the way. I got in trouble. It was good trouble. It was necessary trouble.
Franklin, I know we've got to do something.
I love that. Coffee's going to be my top of mind, too. So hello and welcome to Public Access America. My name is Kid Rock. No, of course, it's Jason. I just love that song. His name is Jeffrey, but we can call him all sorts of things. He doesn't seem to mind. Yeah, I quit coffee. Like, yesterday, I was like, this is what's hurting. Like, four cups of coffee a day. What the? So I stopped and, like, today I feel really, really, really good. And I think that's unique to my case, not to everybody's case, but a happier Jason is always a nice thing to have, you know?
Well, and for me, like I grew up with the whole just swilling coffee all morning until, you know, you were done. And I actually noticed that I was in a lot of pain too. So I went from drinking essentially what was a half a pot of coffee in one shot to I will drink one cup of coffee in the mornings when I go to work. And then sometimes on the weekends, I'll have two cups. So like this morning's a two cup sort of morning.
I believe it. Yeah. And you're still young. You know what I mean? It's just pain.
I certainly don't feel that way.
Pain like terraforms the soul, I like to say. And then, so it's nice to like find something out. I told my friend, I was like, I would love to go to the hospital and go on a conveyor belt and run through it until they fixed me, but I can't afford that. You know what I mean? I have to come.
Wait, why do I keep getting the anal probe?
Yeah, I have had more probes in my genitals and rectum than any man should have, you know? And it was always different answers.
I understand that.
And if anybody just said, dude, 8 cups of coffee? No. You know, you drink some water in there? Maybe, yeah. So I've been telling doctors for the past 5 years, I want a nutritionist. Like, it's not you. You need to treat me once I'm baseline. But I'm never going to be baseline if there's nobody telling me
what's the baseline.
Yeah, what's wrong? Like, my baseline was eating salad for 8 months. Now I know that was wrong because it was coffee. I wasted a lot of time. But a nutritionist might have said, all right, well, you're heavy on the coffee. You're low on the fiber. Switch those, you know?
Right. You know, and for me, it's like kind of trying to figure out what that balance is, you know. I probably haven't had the greatest eating habits as of late, but, you know, it's and what I mean by that is that I changed up my breakfast routine a little bit. But, you know, I'm still like holding steady / losing a little bit of weight. So it's not like I definitely need to do better, but it's also kind of one of those things where it's like, I have also been happy-ish, you know, with my food choice.
Right.
Because I feel good in the morning. Like I don't feel weighed down. I don't feel like I'm sluggish. But at the same time too, it's like, eh, yeah, I probably should not just do what I'm currently doing.
I don't know. But if you want to feel sluggish, do it. And if it seems like a chore, then, you know, you gotta balance that, the joy with the hate, you know what I mean? And the other thing is all of those foods are turned into chemicals that run our body, right? And so for you, your chemical balance is different than my chemical balance. And so when we discuss these things, I think it's interesting because I always keep an individual perspective because I wonder if there's others out there like that. But even the others that are suffering from coffee like I was or am or whatever, they suffer in different ways and they need different nutrition,
chemicals. Let's think about this from a historical objective. You know, especially out here where we have a lot of Native American tribes, you know, whose diet, you know, really depended on fish a lot of the time.
Yeah.
You know, there's been a lot of question in the Native American community about whether or not the lack of fish in the diet has been hurting them. I mean, if you've got tribes that have been living here for 10,000 years, you know, it's real hard to sit down and say, well, no, you know, they've evolved really quickly to not have that as a part of their diet.
Right.
Nobody evolves that really quickly. And I mean, you look at all the different types of people out there, you know, you've got hunter gatherers, you've got agriculturalists, you've got, you know, foragers, nomadic groups.
Yeah.
You've got, you know, groups that have, you know, depended on food from the sea. You've got groups that have depended on bison. You've got groups that have depended upon grains.
Yeah.
You know, it's the idea that, to me, the idea that, it, you know, homogeneously, we all just need one simple set of things just doesn't necessarily make sense.
Right.
Now, you get into, you know, what is now the globalized economy and, you know, for, you know, tens of thousands of years, you had people who were pretty well homogenous. They didn't, you know, really mix with other cultures, other essential tribes outside of their own.
Right.
And now that you have that mix, you know, you have that question. I do think of, you know, as we've seen in more recent years, you know, this whole craze of only eating meat or only eating vegetables and it's like, to me, it's one of those things where the nutritional needs of every person is so varied as it is.
So varied, yes.
So who's to say that, you know, somebody who, you know, doesn't have, one set of, you know, DNA lineage doesn't need more fish or one set of, you know, it's like we all know those people that, you know, have, you know, they always have had certain things or always done certain things, and they feel better doing those things. Yeah. And so for me, it's just kind of that general question of, you know, who are we really, you know?
That's a good point.
And genetically, it's hard to answer that question, you know, and I think that's been like one of the weird things about, you know, the do-it-yourself DNA kits, figuring out where you come from, like, excusing all of the privacy, you know, issues for a moment, trying to figure out, you know, who am I, you know, genetically, who am I? Where did I come from? You know, there is the grand question of, you know, do people that come from the British Isles have a certain set of dietary needs? Do people who come from, you know, the more Germanic tribes a certain set of dietary needs? What about the Mediterranean? What about Turkish? What about, you know, people who come from the Middle East? What about people who come from the heart of Africa? You know, it's a really interesting idea to me, but at the same time too, it's also one that I can see any number of bad actors deciding to take that information and, you know, try to pose eugenics 2.0.
Yeah. I'm thinking about like the Bahamas, because that's where the sugar cane is, right? Like a lot of people just didn't have sugar like that in their lives. I can't imagine another place that grows sugar cane to where like pre-Europeans would have been ingesting a lot of sugar. And then I see why it was really popular, but I'm wondering, like, yeah, you're right. If we could figure out, I'm sitting here figuring like my dad was Italian, my grandma was French. You know, like going through all these things and yeah, I feel better eating meat. You know what I mean?
Well, and you know, you look at even just like some of the interesting anecdotes. So for example, a couple of weeks ago, Debbie and I took a walk with Billy, and I was, you know, being somebody who's, you know, always interested in plants, native wild growth, I saw, you know, one plant and I'm like, it looks like blackberry, but the, no, I bet that's salmonberry. And so I start looking at it. Sure enough, it's salmonberry. And so like, I start looking to see, you know, why do they call it salmonberry? Because, you know, I guess, you know, the berry flesh does look like, you know, if you peel open a salmon, it does have that like orange, right, you know, color to the meat.
Okay.
Well, apparently salmonberry, they actually, you know, the Quileute tribe out here actually used to use the leaves of salmonberry to wrap their fish when they cooked it to give it an enhanced flavor. And I was like, huh, neat.
I like that.
Interesting.
The Mediterranean does that with grape leaves, and I love that.
Exactly. Exactly. And so there's, you know, you have all of these different questions about how, you know, different foods impact the body, you know, why, you know, like at a fundamental level, we all know it's like, hey, you know, raw sugars from, you know, raw fruits and vegetables process better than, you know, processed sugars.
Right.
Because they're more complex. But then when you look at it, it's like, well, why, you know, all of these different ways that they used to cook different things, the question is what's been lost over time? And so for me, like reading how, you know, one tribe out here used the leaves of salmonberry in order to, you know, cook their fish was really interesting to me, you know, because apparently it adds an enhanced flavor profile.
It isn't fish, about like, the berry at all. There was a study that said, like, they compared, I read this about 10 years ago, but people, they used to hunt and expel energy to hunt. And so when they learned to cook their meat and learned to store their meat and learned to get grains and have food supplies readily at hand, they didn't use the energy hunting. So their brains developed more than, say, a gorilla who still just basically hunts all day for sustainment and food and uses that energy for body, not mind. And so I think a lot of what we miss is like the preparation, the you know, the task, the energy it takes to get the food, because it's so easy, you know, it's too.
There's actually two parts to that. One and another part even goes even more primitive than that, and that is the fact that, you know, one of the things you know our primitive ancestors figured out was that eating raw meats took a lot of energy.
Right.
However, when they cooked that meat, it actually took less energy to digest that,
right,
that food. And so that allowed the body to use that energy to improve different functions of the body, like the brain.
Yeah. And when your immune system isn't trying to attack you because you're eating raw meat, then you feel healthier and better, you know?
Right. And so that's where it's always really interesting is like, you know, we've, you know, as humans have evolved because of different, you know, advantages that we've been presented over the years, like the ability to cook our food, the ability to grow our own, you know, fruits and vegetables and grains and all that, the ability to go from having to chase animals in order to survive to being able to figure out how to pen them in and just raise them and cull them as needed.
Right.
Which then of course gets into, I think, one of the notes that you wanted to talk about, which is our food what's in it.
But you just segued into both things. We support local farmers, right? We support
Absolutely.
Local farms. We support bringing the means of production for vegetables and fruit and even meat to inner city food deserts, right? And so I think we have a rub. There's an account in Defense of Animals USA on Twitter, and they keep sending this stuff like the bullfighting, you know, and like the chick culling. I think we're always going to land on the humane dignity in death and the purpose of the animal. A farmer raises its pig, and there's a cost to that. And he doesn't hurt the pig. He doesn't do anything like that. But then the pig has purpose, and it lives, and it's happy. But as it declines, yes, eventually the farmer's going to give it dignity in death, and it's going to go on for a bigger purpose. And I think it,
I will add this, you know, not every farmer, of course, is, you know, practices that sort of
right
thing.
I'm speaking, I mean, not mass production,
the right, well, I mean, even in mass production, surprisingly, there really is a lot of care. But you know, there's always a point, there's always a tipping point, and right, realistically speaking, you know, I mean, any rational meat eater should, you know, should be appalled if the animals are mistreated to a certain, right, you know, mistreated, you know, like, whether there's beatings, whether, you know, their hooves are rotting, whether, mm-hmm, there's, you know, whether they're not being treated for open wounds and things like that. Yeah. I mean, they're, you know, there's a respect and care for animals that most ranchers, I will say, have,
right,
you know, because not because it's, you know, it's part, you know, because, you know, growing up with life and death surrounding you constantly, you know, you do have an element of compassion to you, but also too, like, if you don't take care of your animals, that's your food, that's your money,
right,
and, you know, at best you lose one animal. At worst, you might lose multiple, and your reputation might go down the, mm-hmm, shitter. You could get charged for animal abuse. I mean,
right,
there are some states out there that are, you know, I mean, some very conservative states out there that are very aggressive about how people treat their animals. And I think that's important. It's just that, unfortunately, you have this, the question of what is humane,
right,
in the culling of animals, and you have a group of people who say culling them at all is inhumane,
right, and then we should not eat them at all, but that leaves them no purpose, right, to me, it leaves them no purpose,
it leaves them no natural predator, and what you end up having is then an overpopulation of the animal, and then disease runs rampant through the animals, and then they die a pretty gruesome and horrific death because, number one, they've relied on humanity to give them their, you know, let's say their
right,
their shots in order to keep them healthy, the treatments in order to keep them from, you know, developing sores and any number of different things. You know, because, you know, most people don't realize that flies really attack cattle really hard. Yeah. And if you don't treat their ears, and if you don't treat them, it looks pretty fucking nasty, and they can get some really bad infections.
Right. And I'm not talking about people that treat their animals like that. You know what I mean?
No. But I mean, even when you're doing your best to try and treat your animals, you know, those flies can be pretty vicious.
Yeah, because they evolve too, right?
Exactly. Right. But with cattle, if you leave them with no natural predator, you see you'll see the same thing that happens within like deer populations. You know, a disease will start to run rampant, and then instead of, mm-hmm, you know, having a herd that's contained and controlled and, you know, taken care of, now you just have a diseased pestilence that is running rampant through an area.
Yeah.
And that's, I would argue, even less humane than if you were to just actually take care of the population, cull as you need to, and you know, I would say, mm-hmm, you know, work that system a lot more extensively, scientifically, humanely.
Yeah, and knowing the process, you know what I mean?
And that's just it. And nobody, you know, I won't say nobody. There have been far too many people who don't understand that raising these animals is a lot of work. And even for farmers and ranchers, when you have to cull an animal, there's still an emotional element to
it. Of course.
Because, you know, this is something that you invest your time and money into, but there's also a thankful element to it. Like for us, you know, we'd have cows every year that, you know, they just got too old. They're not, you know, they're not calving anymore.
They've timed out just like people do.
And so those are the ones that, you know, they get a nice happy end of life where, you know, they were free range essentially, yeah, you know, inside of a large, you know, barbed wire enclosure in eastern Montana. And then when it was time, you know, we took them off to be, you know, butchered.
Right.
You know, that was just the way that it was.
So real quick, that's what the running of the bulls is. It's exactly what you described, right? And I think
the running of the bulls is a really interesting thing because I've always had a problem with it.
Really? I did too.
Yes.
Until I actually researched and, you know, wrote that note that I sent you. And, mm-hmm, I really did. I didn't understand it. But when you look at the tradition of it, it's kind, yep, of cool. And then when you follow it through to the end result, It has, to me, it has a happy ending because those bulls go on to feed the entire population of Spain in one way or another at other festivals throughout the year, you know?
For me, the issue was always that, number one, you know, I'm going to leave humanity, like people jumping in front of a large animal.
Right.
Because that's Darwin Award material for me. But number two, during the process, there's usually a few bulls that get injured. Like they'll break legs.
Yeah.
Okay. They'll break their necks. To me, that's the part that I've always had a problem with because, you know, growing up on a ranch, like with my bulls, you know, when it was time to call them, you know, I wasn't going to run them down the street and see if they, number one, hit anybody right. or number two, fell and broke a leg.
Good point.
Like there was I understand that it's tradition and I understand that, you know, I mean, it's a very long, long, long tradition, yeah, if I remember yeah. correctly.
And most of these are 4 to 6 steer, bulls. Mm-hmm. So, but I that is a point I didn't even consider. How interesting.
So, I mean, that's the problem that I've always had. It's, you know, I think...
Not the bullfight afterwards.
Well, I mean, you know, that's an interesting one, too, because, you know, for me, you know, as a hunter, as a conservationist,
yeah.
putting an animal down as quickly and humanely as possible is the ultimate goal.
Right.
Like, you know, at least with, like, say, American rodeos, for example, there's never a goal of having the bull get killed or, you know, anything like that.
Right.
Shit happens. And you can talk about and make the argument about whether or not the whole thing is humane and whether it's animal exhibition. There's certainly an argument to be made about that. Absolutely. Okay. But at least with American rodeo, the goal was never to have, you know, the animals get injured during the process.
Right.
It happens. Whereas, you know, some of these traditions, absolutely, that's what you were after, is that you wanted the bull to essentially, you know, unalive.
Okay, right. And tire itself out until it gives up and presents itself to you to die.
Or you know, in some cases, they try to run them into certain walls so that way they'd break their neck and things like that.
Wow.
You know, there's always, you know, for me, it's just that, like, I understand that taking an animal's life isn't for everybody.
Right.
But for those of us who've done it multiple times, it's about doing it as quickly as possible to keep the animals from suffering.
Okay, that's the dignity.
Exactly.
And going on to feed other people is purpose. Like
absolutely.
I wrote down here, I can see the soul in an animal's eyes, but I also know from growing and learning that purpose is the meaning of life, even for animals. And so giving them dignity in life, dignity in death, and purpose throughout that, I like mm-hmm. that. And feeding community to me is a purpose that's well represented, and that animal should be proud, you know?
You know, and for me, like the bull, you know, with the whole quote unquote bullfight, you know, if it's as long as it's just like the showmanship of the matador and they're, right. you know, the end goal, you know, in the ring is not, you know, trying to get the animal to kill itself mm-hmm. or, you know, taking pot shots at the animal with a sword in order to kill it.
Right.
You know, I'm fine with the showmanship. I mean, I can't sit there and say, well, American rodeo, but Spanish bullfighting.
Right, like, right, right.
Like, I can't do that, you know, but the showmanship of it, absolutely. Like, I think the showmanship of it is absolutely beautiful. I think it's a fantastic tradition in that realm.
Yeah, but no, yeah. Really.
For me, my concern is always going to be that if the goal is that the animal dies at the end,
mm-hmm.
then I want it to be done as quickly and humanely as possible. That goes for cattle in any part of the world.
Agreed.
As well as, you know, as somebody who's a hunter, you know, my goal is always that, you know, if an animal is to die, it needs to die quickly and humanely.
Agreed. I put down six injured in bull run, but all bulls die. You know,
right.
Like, yes. And that's what I have an issue with. It's what you just described, the sword at the end, the tiring the animal out. So it gives up, you know, like
right.
that to me is an animal in fear, not an animal. And the other thing is these bulls they're driven to town to be sold for bullfights or
mm-hmm.
food. Right. Right. Or other,
right.
other. They didn't say what the other was, but somebody also said these steers are pretty crappy meat takes a long time to cook it. They cook it in red wine and then they put it in a stew for another day. So it's like 48-hour process, you know?
Which, you know, that, I mean, that's probably just how the bulls are raised. Now,
maybe
here's where, but I mean, here's where this gets interesting. Now, most likely, without having looked anything up, if I were to just kind of take a guess, the matador tradition probably comes from the fact that, number one, you know, when bullfighting was probably first done, they didn't have the kind of mechanisms that we do now for quickly and humanely right. putting down an animal. So getting the bull to be tired so that way they could deliver, you know, a one-shot kill
that's a
was probably
point,
the element.
You go in the wild and you get somebody to distract them like a rodeo clown or a matador with a cape. Yeah, yeah, I could see that, cavemen. That
there's,
doing something
I could
like
see
that.
Where, well, not even cavemen. I can think of something like this. You know, 500-600 years ago, mm-hmm. being absolutely, because firearms weren't exactly common in those
right.
days.
Right, but I mean, Stonehenge was built to funnel animals to a point to where the people could get them. You know, so it was all about directing the animals, tiring the animals out, and that kind of stuff. But you're right. Now that we have better methods, like the chick calling, right? What did they do before they had grinders to these chicks? So, yeah, these are all good points.
I mean, so it's kind of one of those things where, like any number of things, I'm not going to say that it was wrong, because probably for the time when these traditions had first developed, it was actually probably the best method that they had. And then it just got turned into like a huge festival, like a huge
right.
gathering.
Because more,
you know,
people wanted
population.
To see it and eat.
And exactly. And, you know, you probably had kings and rulers that would put on these magnificent displays in order to show their wealth, their prowess, whatever.
And to feed the people. Yeah.
Exactly. So it's hard, you know, it's hard to sit down and say that the tradition itself was bad from the beginning, because to be perfectly honest, it might actually have been the best method that they had for the time. And it's right. something that's continued on. So it's always one of those, it's like, you know, on one hand, on the other hand, and there's this constant balancing act of, you know, why a person or why a group does something that they do. And there was probably at one point a very valid reason yeah. to do what they did. And it was probably because it was the best method that they had.
But
the
now
time.
It's just become unevolved.
It isn't, I would say, like if we were to apply a certain standard of humanity right. or humaneness to the process, you know, 600 years ago, it was probably the most humane method that there was. No. Under today's methods and under today's availabilities, probably not.
But my little point in here about the steer, the bull being tough meat is, this seems like a lot of work for food that's barely edible. You know,
you have to think about it this way. Cows, bulls have not always been the size that they have been.
Right.
You know, the meat was probably not as good as you wanted it to be. But when you didn't have access to it, hell, any meat was better
any
than
meat
zero.
Was better than that. And but what I'm saying is now being evolved, would you? I mean, it seems like a lot of work for just meat that's not very good.
Well, I mean, this is where I'm always going to kind of like play the advocate here, the devil's advocate. Who says it's not very good? You know, there are probably people who think that it's one of the finest delicacies that you can eat.
Yeah, in Spain, only one guy distributes it, and he is so rich and so happy about that. He treats it right so that it comes out good, because you can do that with any meat. It just seems weird. Like around here, I don't know. It seems like a waste of time. Let those bulls live and maybe bring in some better steer and walk them through and then do the show. I don't know.
Well, you know, and here's the thing, like for me, it's one of those things, like, you know, when I did more hunting, cured animals it was a process to cure them. And you know, you can make the same argument that deer meat, elk meat, antelope.
I'm just searching for a solution.
Pronghorn,
you know.
I think the solution, there really isn't a solution in this case, and that's the real answer. Like, if, you know, unless you go with a very specific, if the solution is about food, then yeah, maybe a better source of food. If the solution is about dealing with animals humanely, there's probably a different solution. If the solution is about honoring tradition, yeah, there's probably a continued / better solution. There's just not a great solution that involves all of this.
There is a clause in the bullfighting to where the audience can pardon the bull. And I think that's cool. Like, I think they could have the bullfight, tire the bull out, and then put the bull out to pasture, you know, to live its life that way, and then have meat like at the festival. Just have a festival, you know what I mean? Like, we have county fairs all the time, but we don't watch them kill the animals, right? We don't, like, watch the animals run around and then eat them, right?
Well, it depends on your county fair.
I guess so. I've never been to a county fair. Like, I've had pig at a county fair where I watched a pig race, but that doesn't mean they were the same pigs that fresh.
Right.
You know what I mean?
No. And I think, you know, that's one of those things that really, really, really depends. You know, you know, some places, and of course, this is the ones where, you know, a certain group of people hammer on this, you know, they're really understanding and attached to the way that, you know, animals are raised, animals are culled, animals are cooked and served. It's just, you know, that's been part of, you know, agricultural life for, you know, millennia.
Yeah.
So.
Okay. Well, I don't have a problem with the meat eating, and I don't care what you're eating. Like we talked about, it's just, it seems like, but the whole, the running part is the issue, because that's where the chances are they'll get hurt the most in an inhumane way. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But it did start with, like, ranchers, like, getting their bulls excited so they could get them to town. Like, you know, how you drive steer. And then stupid kids in the region would be running in front of the bulls because they literally had nothing else to do. And so now, in 2020, they haven't done this in 3 years, by the way. They just brought it back after the pandemic. They could have just let this, like, slowly fade, you know?
But then you have the greater question of national tradition.
Yeah, I guess.
You know, whether or not you let national tradition fade. You know, as a country that's only about 250 years old, it's hard for us to sit down and you know, say that some country or some culture that's had, you know, a tradition for, you know, 5, 6, 7 thousand years, whatever, let something that they've been doing for that long just go by the wayside. You know,
I'll just call it cringe, then.
I mean, that's fair.
Yeah.
I think
we have traditions we've evolved from, you know, we have more than one gender now. And so we've evolved past calling people just he or just she. You know, there's a new, I don't even want to talk about that. There's something more important to talk about than that. Jeffrey, turns out that I think I have weed killer in my urine, and I don't know why.
And you remember how I've talked about this before, about how Cheerios is one of the largest places where you find glyphosate?
Yep. Yeah, you said it about 3 times last week, and then I went to Twitter, and I went to the news, and there was something that said 80% of all people, and I clicked on that, and the first one was 80% of all Americans have glyphosate in their urine. And so, like, but first they did a study with like 2,500 people that was supposed to represent all of America. Do you know, because you're a data guy, you're an agriculturist, and you know all about this. So you're kind of like a guest on this. You're a guest expert on this. I want to know how did they get the poll? Like, how did they decide? How can this represent 80% of people when it's 2,500 people?
So, sampling is a fun one.
Yeah, but can we trust it? That's all I'm saying.
Would I trust it? I personally would prefer more data.
Right.
Just because, you know, without knowing where the samples come from, like that's always my biggest problem.
And they're going forward with that. They're funding that. They're working on that.
I mean, there's always that question of, you know, there's always the question of what does this question work for their study?
Right.
Now, as a data person, you kind of have to understand that there's always a starting point, and that starting point is usually a lot smaller than you want it to be. Because, I mean, you know, realistically, it's like, you know, do you want to go ask for a million vials of pee? No, you really don't.
Right.
Especially if you start sampling and you don't find anything.
So we're going to have to eventually in a year or two be like 23andpee.com.
Oh God.
I'm sorry.
I feel sorry for the post office. Another vial of piss, another vial of piss. But you know, but that's the thing though, is that, you know, a lot of these places, there's certain collection places or certain testing places, okay, where people will go in, they'll provide the sample, then that sample will be medically collected by a research facility, and then it gets sent on to wherever else, or they'll test it right there and they'll send the results on to
or you go to your doctor and they just add it to the list of things that's tested for.
So that's always one of the things that's okay, really interesting about some of these tests and the way that they perform.
So is this even worth paying attention to then? Glyposol? What is it?
Glyphosate?
Yeah, glyphosate.
So glyphosate is the active ingredient in a chemical called Roundup. Mm. Roundup, if you're familiar with it, is known to kill anything that's green.
Right. Everybody knows what Roundup is, unless you're in the inner city.
Now, here's one of the fun things that most people don't realize. Too.
What?
So to give you a little bit of history on something that I actually wrote a research paper on back in high school.
Yes.
And so my research paper is 20 years old on this. So one of the things about the time, you know, about Roundup Ready stuff, everybody, you know, freaked out about this whole, about the whole idea that a plant being Roundup Ready isn't natural. Number one, that's actually not correct. How we found out about it is actually far more sinister than most people realize. So how did we find out what Roundup Ready was? So Roundup, we knew, killed everything that was green. It was a great weed killer. It was a great way to, you know, take fields and make sure that they were barren and free of weeds before you did your planting.
Why?
It was a great post-emergent.
Why?
So why?
Yeah, I'm sorry. The whole thing is, it's not the whole thing, but where do weeds come from and why do we even need to get rid of them?
So when it comes down to like the grains that you eat, when you're harvesting your crops, there are a lot of materials that end up getting taken up into your combine.
Right, right.
Some of those things are, you know, they're weeds. They are a non-desired plant. They either have no nutritional value. They spread really easy. Mm-hmm. They're annual plants that, you know, take over specific, you know, they take over, you know, places that are fallow and barren. And they're not exactly what you want to have in your crop. And when a farmer goes to sell their crop, depending on how much extra material there is in the crop, they actually get docked pay-wise on all of that extra material, because that all has to be sorted out, that all has to be cleaned out before it can go on to like your, whether it's your chemical processing in order for that to become next year's seed crop, or even to become your cereal grains for the food that you're going to eat. Okay. You can't just have thistle showing up in your food, unfortunately.
Right, right. That's a good point. That's what I wanted to...
So all that to go back to, the way that farmers look to control this was through spraying their summer fallow. So what that did was that kept all of these plants that came up from going to seed.
Right.
And so you wouldn't have that material showing up in your crop next year,
right,
or that year, depending on when you spray.
You spray before you seed.
But you know, if you sprayed before you seeded, you know, that would help reduce the amount of potential weeds you would have.
Right, right.
Problem is that as ground gets tilled, weeds like to take over areas that have been disturbed. So every time you turn the soil, it gives you a new place for seeds to potentially settle in and grow.
Gotcha.
But also any seed material that is in there, a lot of seeds can stay dormant for up to like 10 years.
Wow.
So you might have weeds that were already in the soil that, thanks to you turning it, now have a better chance of actually germinating.
Okay.
Now, Roundup Ready. This is where this gets fun. Everybody thinks that Roundup Ready just magically appeared, and that somehow we started spraying our crops with all this stuff. Well, it's actually not the case. So the company that created Roundup,
Monsanto.
Actually, Monsanto, they actually discovered that, you know, there was a plant that did not react to glyphosate. Not because they were out doing a bunch of testing, but because they actually had a chemical leak in one of their waterways.
Right.
And this plant didn't die from exposure to glyphosate. So now, instead of being alarmed, they went, holy shit, what if we could take whatever this is and put this into crops? So that way you could spray this when the crops came out, and that would get farmers the ability to get rid of all of the weeds
all the time,
all of the crop. And I mean, when you think about it, it's actually a very brilliant idea. Mm-hmm. Farmers would no longer have to worry as much about whether or not they're going to have secondary material in their crop.
Right.
And it's fantastic. It's exciting. So,
and here's results of production they prove themselves, right? Better fruit, right. Bigger fruit, lasts longer, it tastes better.
It's not even about any of that. It's about the fact that, number one, your crops are not competing with with other plants, number one. And number two, it's about the fact that now your profit margin isn't going affected by, you know, all these other conditions.
Exactly.
So then you end up with this. Now you end up with the question. Now this is like, I want to say late 80s, early 90s. Mm-hmm. How do you take this thing that we found and make this other thing? Now, there's two ways that you can make this happen. There is natural selection, which is you plant a bunch of seeds, you spray the field, and if it comes up and doesn't die, you have now this little group of seeds that is potentially, you know, it's resistant to Roundup. Right. And you have to sit there and do that over and over and over and over and over and over until you actually get enough of a seed crop in order to do that.
Right.
Or you can find out what is the gene that makes the plant Roundup ready in this one, but not in this one. And then basically take over that natural selection and make that happen a lot faster.
Right.
And that's what science looks to do.
Where it is,
it takes genes from one plant, puts, you know, splices them into another plant in order to elicit a similar response.
And we did that with plant splicing before we did genetic splicing. Like, we've always been evolving our crops. So this was just jump in the evolution, though.
It was a shortcut. It was a wormhole, essentially, if you want to think about it that way. It was warp drive.
Right.
You know, it took something that existed naturally in another plant, and what scientists theorize would eventually be available in this plant, but just made the process happen a lot faster.
Right.
So, cut to now you have different Roundup Ready crops. I think Roundup Ready Oats was the first crop, if I remember correctly, to actually be Roundup Ready. Because one of the things that you end up with in oats is wild oats. And oats and wild oats are not the same. They are not nearly as pleasant. They have sharp little barbs in them. It's a pain in the ass.
Okay.
But getting rid of those wild oats was actually a huge benefit for farmers. Now, imagine if you could take that and put that into a bunch of different crops. It's really exciting. Durum, spring wheat, Durum. Winter wheat, oats. You could do this to canola. You could do this to flax. You could do this to corn, chickpeas, right? Or garbanzo beans. Corn, you could do this to any number of soybeans. You could do this to any number of crops out there. But one of the things that I postulated in my paper, and it was a concern at the time, was the thing about natural selection is that the more that you use something, the more likely a plant is to evolve a protection to it.
Okay.
And so my question that I postulated at the time was, are we going to see the rise of Roundup resistant weeds? And the answer is absolutely, you could. You absolutely could. And because like anything else, if you spray enough times, mm-hmm. eventually there's going to be one time where something has reproduced and the seed is going to come out and it's going to be Roundup ready.
Well, yeah, because
you're going to end up.
There was that one initial plant that was Roundup ready, right? And so a weed could happen with a weed too, right?
Absolutely. It's evolution. Mm. The idea that plants don't evolve the same way. Plants actually evolve a lot faster simply because they have many generations within time that we have one generation.
Right.
So the idea that this couldn't happen was, you know, a big problem. Now here's the thing. Like anything else, if you use something to label, it should minimize the effects of what you're using. However, as humans go, well, if a little is good, a lot is better, right?
Yeah, that's the way we generally do it.
So you run into this problem of, are we using the appropriate amount of chemicals on our crops? Now, one of the things that we have found particularly problematic, especially over the last 60, 70 years, is you end up seeing a lot of these chemicals end up in waterways. The more chemical that you use, and depending on the timing of using it, the more likely you are to have runoff. The salt and sea, for example, is a great example of this. Mm-hmm. So the salt and sea didn't have a natural outlet. So the water would just pool up in there, but it didn't actually refresh. It didn't go anywhere.
Right.
So when farmers during that time were spraying all these chemicals around, during the 60s, it wasn't a big deal because, you know, there were fish in there, people were boating in there. It was like this great destination that everybody wanted to go to. But 20, 30 years of agricultural runoff poisoned the water, and it started killing the fish. The place started to become very alkaline. It smelled really bad. And suddenly it was no longer a destination place because you weren't having water refresh.
Right.
You know, they closed off the source of where the water was coming from. And all of that runoff contributed to just essentially nuking the fish population, which of course then turned this into a horrible smell. Then you have the grand question of, do I want my kids bathing in the chemicals of the Salton Sea? And the answer was an overwhelming no.
No, right.
So,
but that's how we also get E. coli in our lettuce, right? Like because of the runoff, the infected runoff that actually goes into other areas.
No. E. coli is more of an issue of fecal matter.
Right. Yeah, but I heard it was from livestock runoff that went into the
livestock runoff is different than livestock runoff is different than chemical runoff from it's a different agricultural runoff. Okay. Yes. In different agricultural runoff, but yes.
Okay. I didn't want to take us too far off, so I'll just, yeah, you're right.
So all that to say, if you have that much runoff mm-hmm. from using different chemicals, the question then begs, if you're in places that don't experience a lot of runoff or it's getting into your water table, then what are the chances are that the plant is actually intaking that into its seed, depending on when you spray?
Okay.
So one of the things that I had postulated at the time was we had no idea how much of it was going to turn up in our food, and we didn't know what that would look like.
Right.
Now, obviously, if you have glyphosate in, if you have just a bottle of Roundup, you don't drink the bottle of Roundup. That'll kill you.
Right.
But if you dilute it down, could you drink it? Yeah, it's just not going to be good for you.
Well, so in what way? And is Roundup just straight glyphosate, or is it other?
There's inert chemicals
okay,
in there.
Yeah,
as
I'm
well.
Just curious. Okay.
But the active ingredient is glyphosate.
But that's what, if you pour a bottle of Roundup into a 5-gallon bottle of water, you might be able to drink it, but you're not going to feel good. And there's short and long-term consequences to that. But yeah, how does it get into the food? How does it get into my, my tomatoes? Does it get into my cucumbers? You know?
No, that's the grand question. So any crop that is Roundup ready is going to have probably the potential to have it absorb into the food. Now, here's where this gets fun, because now we get to go back into the genetics. Are there genetics that inhibit the uptake of glyphosate?
Maybe from the root, right?
I don't know.
That's what I'm, that's where my mind just
was.
From
the root or from the berry.
Right.
Because remember, wheat is not, wheat is a seed. It's a berry, the berry of the grass.
Yeah, it is.
So it's an interesting concept.
I love my bread with wheat berries in it. Oh my God.
So one of the things that we have to consider and take into account in this is that at different stages of seed development, your plant is uptaking a lot of water because it's trying to plump up that berry. Now, depending on when you spray, you're going to end up with, you know, a high level of water intake. And if you're spraying a ton of chemical on your crop, there is a really good chance that, number one, it's going to get down to the soil, it's going to get into the soil, and that root is going to take it up. Now, you run into many numbers of questions here, and unfortunately, this is a place where I'm not necessarily going to have all the answers.
Okay.
So, over time, chemicals break down. That's very much the case. Glyphosate is supposed to it's supposed to be inert inside of 48 hours.
Wow, okay.
So that's one of the bonuses of glyphosate, because, you know, when you look at any number of different chemicals that you can spray, their half-life of the chemical can actually be very long. For example, Tordon can have a very long half-life, especially if you don't use it according to label. The reason I know this is because my stepfather decided that he wanted to try and spray our little garden for weeds, you know, before we planted, but he fucking hosed the shit out of it with Tordon and nothing grew in that spot for 10 years.
Wow. And that's the evolution of weed killers right there.
And I want to say that after I don't even know that that necessarily counts as the evolution so much as this is what happens if you don't use it according to
label. But I mean shortening the life, right? The half-life.
Right.
That, and making a pesticide that is more controlled than is always there. That's what they've always been working towards, I hope.
I will say, though, that, you know, my mom and I still joke about the fact that, you know, after like 3 or 4 years, we tried to plant some crops down where our little garden was, and the only thing that came up was corn, and it was purple and twisted like something out of a fucking horror movie. Wow. It was really weird. So, but that was the biggest question. If farmers aren't using your product according to label, then what's happening to the crop itself? Mm. Now, you always run into that question of, are farmers using more because they're not reading the label, or are they using more because the weeds that they're trying to treat are becoming resistant?
Right. Or do they just not know enough and they think more is better?
That's not. So here's the problem is that for farmers, I believe in every state, you have to get what is called a commercial or an agricultural applicator's license. You actually have to go and you have to test, and you have to show that, number one, you can read the fucking label.
Right.
So that's one of the biggest problems is that, you know, the company itself says, this is what we have determined the safe limits to be. Are those the safe limits? That's a whole different question.
Mm-hmm.
But the company can't control whether or not you are actually using the product according
user
to
user applications may vary.
Exactly. So, you know, for example, you know, you might get enough chemical to treat, let's say, 1,000 acres, but you don't have 1,000 acres that needs to be treated.
Right.
You maybe just have 100. So instead of using that amount that's for 1,000 acres on 1,000 acres, you're using the amount on 1,000 acres on just 100 acres, and you're just essentially nuking that spot.
Exactly. Because you don't know better.
So,
or you just think more is better.
You do know better. You're just like, well, fuck it. If a little's good, a lot is better. You
run into what we call it
the farmer's dilemma. If the price is bad, you grow more crop. But if the price is good, you grow more crop. So anything that affects your ability to grow crop, you want to handle as quickly as possible.
Okay.
So that then leads into this whole question of what happens when you apply way too much chemical over an area and it gets into your food.
Yeah.
Now, there is, I think, the million-dollar question, because this is one of those things where I don't know that we know enough at this point. There is a lot to say that are people getting sick from Roundup? Absolutely. I do believe that, because it's a chemical. And if you're not wearing the proper protective gear when you're applying it,
okay,
or using it, because the thing is that Roundup isn't just available on a commercial schedule. You can also buy it at fucking Walmart to use it in your own yard.
Well, so users may absorb it.
Absolutely. It's a chemical. It's a spray. If you get it on your skin, it's gonna get in you. That's just the way that any chemical works.
That's the truth.
Now, I'm going to preface this by a little story that actually happened to me. My grandmother's ex-husband was a farmer, and he used to play a fun game with the kids, with the boys anyways, called ride on the outside of the spray coop and let me know when the weeds are coming so I can turn up the spray. I didn't have any fucking PPE on. I didn't have any masks or anything. And when I came back home from a summer of literally, you know, spending part of my days riding on the spray coop, I was a fucking mess. I was wheezing. I was sick. And there's also honestly a lot of questions about whether or not like my lung problems developed because I was literally riding on the outside of a fucking spray coop being exposed to chemicals.
Yeah, I got you. My uncle used to
Getting that shit.
My uncle used to have me clean concrete floors with sulfuric acid with no protection at all, you know?
Right. And I mean, under, you know, if, and I guarantee you that if you looked at what the recommended PPE is for dealing with Roundup, it probably isn't fucking nothing.
Right.
So once again, you have this issue of the company might have laid out exactly what the expectations were for you to use their product, that you need to wear goggles, that you need to wear a mask, that you need to wear protective clothing, that you need to wear, you know, I mean, there's even chemicals out there where they flat out tell you that if you're, when you're mixing the chemical, you need to be wearing a respirator.
Yeah.
And there are chemicals that, you know, well, working on the farm that,
anyway,
which, right. So there were, but there were chemicals that I worked with on the farm where we had respirators. Right. And when it was time to work with those chemicals, you put on your respirator. That said, this Roundup has become a chemical that has not just been commercially available for agriculture, but commercially available for anybody who owns a home.
Right.
You can literally go in and buy the mix at Walmart, go back and nuke your driveway, nuke your garden.
Just hope there's no breeze that blows in. You know,
and so you run into this issue of, you know, with all of these chemicals that have been available, if you know, for residential use, you now have what I would call a system of cross-contamination. You have the issue of, you know, is the glyphosate in our food really the problem? Now, I say this because I don't have an answer without knowing whether or not it is an inert version, because remember, glyphosate is supposed to be inert after 48 hours.
Yeah, that's what's been in my head since you said it. Like, what does it matter if there's a glyphosate in my pee if it's going to be inert in 48 hours?
That's the grand question. So if it's, but so if it's inert in 48 hours, is there actually a health problem with it in the food? The answer is I don't know. And it does warrant further study.
I want to say Monsanto and the people that bought Roundup and the EPA, they all say there is not a problem. It isn't a carcinogen, but there was a court case that said they got to look into it further.
And I absolutely would hope and expect that they do. But now when you have glyphosate and it's not inert and it's getting onto your skin,
right,
it's getting into your lungs because you're out spraying in your yard, you're out spraying in the field. There, I would honestly really actually actively expect that there would be health problems associated with that. You're supposed to be wearing protective equipment, and dumbasses like myself have not done that in the past. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, we all go, oh, well, if it's available over the counter, it should be safe, right?
Yeah.
Well, shit, how many poisons do we know that are quote unquote safe that we can buy over the counter that tell you don't fucking use this unless you're using X, Y, and Z?
Yeah.
Just because it's available over the counter doesn't mean it's necessarily safe.
Oh, I agree. I agree.
So you run into that question of cross-contamination, especially in a data realm, which is where I'm headed with this. The amount of people who would potentially just eat glyphosate, like this is where the science comes in. does it surprise me that 80% of people might be exposed to glyphosate either through their food or through their own personal dealings? No, that number seems, that number would seem very feasible to me. However, the question is of exposure. What is your exposure? And this is where we can actually test in a number of different ways, because there's going to be people who, let's say they don't eat anything that has glyphosate in it. All they do is they eat, you know, the most organic of the organic. No chemicals, no pesticides, no nothing. Okay, great. That'll give us, that can give us a potential baseline. You're going to have the people who are literally just eating what they buy at the grocery store, Cheerios, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. They're going to be the ones that just are only exposed to glyphosate in the food. And so you then run into this whole question of whether or not, you know, that is the problem. Then you're going to have the people who may or may not be exposed to glyphosate in their food, but they're definitely going to be, you know, exposed to glyphosate because they are using the chemical.
Or in their water supply, I just want to add.
In their potentially in their water supply. Now, local water is supposed to be, you know, local water systems are supposed to be testing what all is in there.
Yeah.
So the question really then becomes, you know, is that, you know, is there glyphosate in the water, or, you know, how they're looking at that. There are so many ways that you can test this cross-contamination of glyphosate to figure out where is the actual threat.
Right.
And that is where things get really difficult. And so from my perspective, there's still a lot of unknowns, and I'm not going to pretend to have the answers, and I'm not going to pretend to say that, oh no, it's fine in your food, but not, right, it's right. It's fine in your food as well. I can't say that.
As a scientist,
you know, I'm very comfortable with saying things like that and saying, I don't know.
Well,
the answer is I don't know, because nobody has studied it yet, or there hasn't been enough studies on it yet. But I would argue that this particular study is going to lead us down that question of, is there actually a problem here?
Right.
Yeah, sure. The EPA, Monsanto, the company that bought it, I want to say it's Bayer now.
Bayer, yeah.
They might all say that it's fine, mm-hmm. and they might all be right, but they might not be. Right. And the thing is that there just hasn't been enough studies done on it to find out, you know, if it's a problem, where does the problem actually come from?
Right.
Is it coming from the food? Is it coming from the use of the chemical, either in agriculture or in residential? Is it both?
Or is it your body? Is it just your body unable to deal with it? A weaker body with a chemical in it is going to react differently than a fit body. A young body and an old body are going to react differently to a chemical in it repeatedly. You know, if it's an inert in 4 hours, but you eat something that has it in it heavily every day, it's going to build up. It's going to be there and it's going to hurt you. I'm just tuning in because, hey, everybody, thank you for listening to Public Access America. Come back Thursday because we're not done with this conversation, but we have other stuff too. Love you. Bye.
To those who would tear the world down, we will defeat you.
This is our moment.
This is our time. To those who seek peace and security, we support you.
Yes, we can.
And to all those who have wondered if America's beacon still burns as bright, tonight we prove once more that the true strength of our nation comes not from the might of our arms or the scale of our wealth, but from the enduring power of our ideals, democracy, liberty, opportunity, and unyielding hope.
Let me tell you something you already know. The world ain't all sunshine and rainbow. It's a very mean and nasty place, and I don't care how tough you are, it will beat you to your knees and keep you there permanently if you let it. You, me, or nobody is going to hit as hard as life.
Ask not.
Yes, we can.
What your country can do for you.
I have a dream.
Ask what you can do to your country.
My poor little children.
Yes, we can.
Will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character.
I don't have to tell you things are bad. Everybody knows things are bad. It's a depression.
In this lifetime, you don't have to prove nothing to nobody except yourself.
But it ain't about how hard you hit. It's about how hard you can get hit and keep moving forward. How much you can take and keep moving forward.
That's how winning is done.
Welcome to Public Access America.
Yes, we can.
Sunday live streams on YouTube.
I wanted to run out of that tunnel for my dad.
On Twitter.
To everyone that I work with.
Apple Podcasts, Stitcher Smart Radio, Public, and Spotify.
Yes, we can.
Public Access America. History in the making. Making history in the making.